2023-99, Northern Nevada Homes LLC versus GL Construction, Inc. We have Mr. Rusby for the appellant, Mr. Beasley for the respondent. Justice Stiblich is disqualified in this case, as recused, so we have Senior Justice Seda sitting in her place. And Justice Perigueux has joined the panel. We're ready to proceed. Mr. Rusby, do you want to save some time for a rebuttal?
Yes, please, Your Honor. If I could reserve 3 minutes.
I'll take a look at the clock.
Try to keep it. Go ahead. Good morning, Your Honors.
I want to make sure, Mr. Beasley, can you hear?
I'm going to try. I thought that it might, you know, make it more clear.
Sure.
But it isn't working.
Elizabeth, can you call Brian?
We'll just be at ease for a second.
Yeah,
let's make sure that works.
Okay.
We'll just be at ease. So we welcome our two Reno attorneys to the Southern panel. Welcome to Las Vegas and to our courthouse.
we're only renters.
Yeah. Thank you for being here, both of you. We appreciate it.
We're tenants.
Yes, renters.
From the bench?
Test.
How's that?
Come on, Nancy.
Can you hear us? Ryan?
Talk.
Yeah.
I'm talking. Can you hear me?
Okay.
You don't usually have to tell me to talk. How's that? Does that sound better?
Better.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great.
Oh, great.
Okay. Thanks, right, Brian.
Ready to go. Brian, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Mr. Rusby, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Rusby, and I represent the appellant, Northern Nevada Homes, in this matter. This case essentially involves two issues. The first is whether a net recovery analysis should apply in cases where there's multiple claims, multiple parties. And the second issue is whether, under a net recovery analysis, whether the respondent in this case can be considered the prevailing party according to NRS 18.010 and 020. And we submit that the respondent cannot in these circumstances, and therefore the award of fees and costs to respondent should be reversed. This court has previously applied a net recovery analysis in the case of Parity versus Boudetti. And it has also applied it in other circumstances in two prior cases. What we have seen thus far is that in circumstances where there are multiple claims, multiple parties, whether they are consolidated together or they are voluntarily joined together in this case, as well as when there involves multiple claims and the amounts need to be aggregated, that the court has taken the approach that the case, the entire action, must be looked at as a whole, essentially to determine for prevailing party status who is the winner and who is the loser, which is the important analysis. We submit that a net recovery analysis is appropriate in this case. This case involved claims by my client initially. Counterclaims were brought. In fact, a motion was filed to bring those and join those into the case and have one single case.
Were those closely related, the counterclaims, to the settled claim?
No.
In nature?
They involved different, distinct issues and facts, but they involved the same parties, roughly. And that's why I believe that they were joined in the case. I don't think that, though, is the determining factor, because in the Parity case, it involved a similar situation, same parties, somewhat similar claims, but distinct claims that could stand on their own alone. It involved three separate breach of contract claims regarding construction for different properties, as well as defamation claims and, I believe, libel claims. And the court still held, under those circumstances, that the entire case should be looked at as a whole to determine who prevailing party status is. And we believe that to do so really includes a functional analysis where substance is put over form and the case is looked at from an entire perspective. It encourages settlement, which would have really helped in this case at that stage. It discourages unnecessary further litigation. It conserves judicial resources. It produces fair and equitable results. And it discourages unreasonable conduct by litigants, which I posit was exactly what happened in this case. And what we had in this case was years worth of litigation. I think it was three, maybe even more years of litigation where my clients brought claims, pretty substantial claims. Mr. Beasley represented the defendants for a period of time, and then Insurance Defense Counsel came in. And from then on out, Mr. Beasley was essentially absent from the case until the end when it came time for trial. We go to trial. We have a four-day jury trial. After the conclusion of evidence, we make a motion for judgment as a matter of law, which is granted by now Justice Stieglitz. And before we had went to trial, we agreed to separate the cases because there was a lot that was going to be presented. There was multiple witnesses, lots of documents. And so we settled right before we were about to give our opening arguments. We couldn't resolve the entire case because of the demands that were being made. As you can see from the motion for attorney's fees, the claim of the respondents was only $7,000. They wanted $70,000+ in attorney's fees to settle the case. I submit that with the net recovery analysis, it will prevent that type of what I would submit would be overreaching and really attorney-driven further litigation at that point. And then, so the next day, we go to a half-day bench trial. We lose at the bench trial. There were some defenses that we had, and there was essentially an agreement where all of this would have been offset, but because of some procedural issues that happened in the case, and I believe Justice Stieglitz was correct about this, that it was appropriate for a judgment to be entered for the defendant counterclaims in that. And then we proceeded to the attorney's fees phase of it.
Can I ask you a question? And this pertains to the settlement. And you consider this proceeding to judgment then, as the settlement actually proceeding to judgment. But it wasn't part of a judicially determined judgment.
No, there was no judgment.
Okay. And how do you square that with Works versus Kuhn?
Well, I believe that Works versus Kuhn, as well as the other cases, that would really apply if we were asking for attorney's fees and we were saying we were the prevailing party. But that's not really the issue in this case. It's not a case where one party has to be the prevailing party over the other. We submit in this case that there is no prevailing party. We couldn't, under the Works case, I believe they were looking at NRS 18.010.
They were.
I could be off. But so we wouldn't have any claim under that anyways because our settlement was for $362,000. And so if we were to be claiming prevailing party status, I don't believe we could because we didn't have a judgment. And then under Works and some of the other cases that provide that you have to have a judgment, we wouldn't qualify for that.
And you don't have any Nevada authorities for your position here?
Other than parity and the line of cases that it cites, no. This really is kind of a new extension of previous existing precedent.
So you would be asking us to establish a new criteria, if you will, for determining recovery, period, pretty much.
Yes, an extension. This circumstance just hasn't been before the court before. And so what we're asking is that the court extend what it has already said to situations where there is a multi-party, multiple claim litigation where both parties essentially prevail. And I believe that, even without a judgment, we are still considered that we prevailed on our claims in the sense that we were forced to go to court to litigate, and we recovered $362,000 right before the case was going to go to a jury. I have cited some precedent in my briefings where many courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, they've said that in the sense of prevailing in your litigation or obtaining the result that you sought, it's not dependent on whether you have to go all the way to get a judgment. It's whether you obtain some relief that you sought in the case as a whole. And I submit that a settlement for this amount that we have obtained relief. And so when we're comparing the two different results that were obtained, in our case, $362,000, in their case, $7,000, just under that circumstance, I think that the case needs to be looked at as a whole to determine whether the party who really only obtained $7,000 is the prevailing party in the case as a whole, which is essentially what their argument is and what would be the only basis that they could get attorneys.
So under your analysis, prevailing party would be determined simply by a mathematical calculation of multiple parties coming together in one related, one set of related cases.
That's correct, Your Honor. It looks at a net recovery. So whoever at the end of the day obtained more money, that they would be considered the prevailing party if we were under the analysis of...
So you could lose in one case and win in another related case, or at least bring in more money by some form or fashion of resolution, and be considered the prevailing party based on nothing more than money, right?
I think there could be circumstances where if money is not the relief sought, if it was injunctive relief, if it was some other relief, that would have to be considered in that circumstance. Here, the issue really only was money. There wasn't any other injunctive relief or anything else that was really sought in the trial on the case or at the end of the day. But yes, I believe that the best way is if we have multiple parties, multiple claims, they all recover on some, they don't recover on others. You have to look at the end result from the whole of the case, not just a kind of a form over substance subset where you're just looking at each individual claim and saying you prevailed on one claim, therefore you're the prevailing party. If a party chooses to bring claims into a case like that occurred in this, they voluntarily decided to make their claims a part of our case. And therefore, they are subject to a net recovery analysis on the case as a whole.
But you know you're rolling the dice on this, because if we affirm by order or opinion, and the next person who comes along and wins a minor type judgment in a case like this, and maybe the attorney's fees will be $50,000, maybe the attorney's fees will be $80,000, there'll be case law now that says that they're the prevailing party. So do you really want us to pursue your argument in this matter that they should not get $10,000 of attorney's fees and $390 in costs? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I would say for my clients, yes, that this is important and we do want to pursue it. I do see in a circumstance of Justice Cherry, just like you said, that puts really the parties in a real difficult position when you're at trial, because if you have a really large claim, you're going to submit it to the jury, and the only way that you're afraid that there is a counterclaim and they're going to have some massive award of it, or they're at least going to be claiming some massive award of attorney's fees, and thus you can't settle with them at that point, it really puts settling on the main claim a really difficult position for that other party when both the parties want to settle, but because some other party has some small claim but are demanding exorbitant amount of attorney's fees, just like what occurred in this case. It puts us in a really difficult position because we either choose not to settle consume more judicial resources, continue litigation, when really I think the policy should be to encourage settlement and encourage parties to reasonably work towards that goal, which in this case didn't happen. And if the court affirms, I suspect that it'll happen many more times in the future, that a little claim has so much leverage that it can consume the entire litigation and force every party, even though they're willing to settle, to have to go all the way, including appeal, and I don't know how much further.
Let me ask you this real quickly. How much negotiation was done to achieve this settlement, and why wasn't the attorney's fees and costs part of that discussion?
Well, at the trial, Mr. Beasley was not present at the jury trial portion of it. We ended a little bit early. We had discussions with Mr. Beasley over a course of several weeks trying to settle the case. The amount was, at one point it was $100,000, it was $70,000, I can't remember specifically, but it was so clear at that point that there was just nothing that could be done to settle that case. Essentially, you know, we were really the aggrieved party to a significant amount, and in order to resolve the case and avoid a trial, we basically have to give the majority or a significant portion of it to the party that harmed us and why we're pursuing the case in the first place. We had even made an offer of judgment a couple days before the bench trial portion of it. It was untimely in the respect that it couldn't have been held up because it wasn't within 10 days of the trial, but we made it anyways for $10,000. That wasn't accepted. There really wasn't much more we could do.
And I would anticipate that included attorney's fees and costs.
Right. And I would like to be clear that the attorney's fees and costs that were involved in the counterclaim were minimal at best. There was really, in the entire course of the litigation, other than filing the motion to amend, filing the amended complaint, and then appearing for the trial.
But Judge Stiglitz went through all the appropriate factors in determining what she felt were the appropriate attorney's fees and costs in that case.
She did. We haven't challenged that on appeal. The main issue is this. I do believe that it was really an arbitrary number that was kind of picked out, what maybe she felt was reasonable. It certainly wasn't based on the billing statements that he submitted, because there really were only, I think, maybe three or four entries that amounted to maybe 10 hours on his billing statement that actually related to the counterclaim. And as you can see from the billing statement, I mean, this is one of the problems, the unreasonableness. The things that...
You're out of time. I'm sorry.
Okay, can I just go for 20 more seconds?
No, you're out of time. Okay. Please be seated.
Thank you.
Mr. Beasley, I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. I'll give you that, and I'm going to give Mr. Beasley 17 minutes. And you can use the 17 minutes if you need it. If you don't, that's okay, too.
Okay. James Beasley on behalf of GL Construction. Before I get into my argument, there's several matters that I really want to clear up, because the matters are disturbing to me. I think five times during this statement that opposing counsel gave, he referred to the unreasonable conduct of counsel, myself, you know, in carrying on settlement negotiations for the settlement of the counterclaim. In his opening brief, he made the same argument. At page 5, he said, efforts were made to reach a full and global resolution of the claims and counterclaims, but Mr. Beasley demanded approximately $70,000 out of the settlement money for his alleged fees and costs to settle the counterclaims. Thus, no settlement could be reached regarding the counterclaims, and plaintiffs were forced to conduct a half-day bench trial immediately following the settlement of Northern Nevada Homes claims. In his reply brief on page 5, at the top of the page, he indicates that the only reason respondents' counterclaims were not included in the settlement is because respondent and its counsel were unreasonable in their settlement demands. I said this in my answering brief, and I'll reiterate it now. At no time prior to the resolution of this matter did I have any settlement conference. Did I communicate by email, telephone, or personal conversation in connection with any settlement demand? It simply did not happen. What happened in this case, I did not attend the first 3 days of trial. On the fourth day, I received a telephone call from the clerk's office with the judge's administrative assistant informing me that there had been a settlement. I had no prior notice of any negotiations or the fact that a settlement agreement was going to be entered into. It was my anticipation that we would go to a jury verdict. And I thought that that was very important as far as I was concerned, because I believed in my own heart, okay, that I would be able to show that GL Construction had no liability, you know, for the damages which were being sought by Northern Nevada Homes, or at least a very minimal liability. And the reason I carried with myself that thought was the fact that, according to our testimony, that is Gordon Limich's testimony, GL Construction, GL Construction had not dumped any dirt, okay, on the property after 2008. For that reason, it was our contention, okay, that a statute of limitations defense applied. In addition, GL Construction had the right to assert the defense that Northern Nevada Homes didn't have any standing to make a complaint regarding the dump that had been dumped prior to 2008, because there had been a change of ownership in 2003. The Roman Catholic Bishop transferred it to Northern Nevada Homes, an LLC of which Mr. Fitzgerald was a part. Okay, after that occurred in 2006, Roman Bishop transferred it to Highland Development, in 2003. In 2006, Highland Development transferred the property to UVRP, another LLC, okay, that Mr. Fitzgerald was associated with. And then in 2013, UVRP transferred the property to Northern Nevada Homes. It was our contention, or our theory of the case, that because these transfers had taken place at a time when the alleged damage had already occurred, that is prior to 2008, and there was no mention in the sales documents assigning the right to bring a claim on those trespasses, okay, that Northern Nevada Homes had no right to pursue a negligence claim against GL Construction. There is something else that I would like to mention. If the court looks at the reply brief that was filed by respondents, and if it turns to page 8. The following representation is made. The settlement agreement that was reached between appellant and respondent obligated both respondent, GL Construction, and Gordon Limich jointly and severally to pay the settlement amount. If neither respondent nor Gordon Limich paid the $362,500, appellant could seek to collect from either the full amount of the settlement on the basis of joint and several liability. And it goes on to say, it is simply disingenuous and without merit for respondent to contend that it was not legally obligated to pay the full amount of $362,500 settlement, and that because the settlement was not expressly apportioned between defendants, it is impossible to determine whether appellant received the greater recovery against respondent. In the footnote to that statement, which I contend is a misrepresentation. Okay? The footnote says the settlement agreement that was reached between appellant and respondent is not part of the record in the district court. Respondent's arguments regarding apportionment were made for the first time in respondent's reply in support of its motion for attorney's fees and costs. Thus, appellant did not have the opportunity to present the settlement agreement as an exhibit for the district court's consideration during the original motion briefing. And here's the point that I want to highlight. Okay, because of that statement, appellant says this. Appellant's counsel has not included this document with its supplemental appendix out of fear such inclusion would violate NRAP 30G1 and could subject appellant's counsel to sanctions. If the court wishes to review the settlement agreement, appellant respectfully requests permission to supplement the appendix with the document. No action, I believe, was taken on that. But so that the court has a clear understanding of what that settlement agreement was about, I have made four copies, and I would like to present it to the court at this time. And the reason is this. The settlement agreement doesn't obligate or impose any joint and several liability on either GL Construction or Gordon Limage. Moreover, as is typical in any or most releases, there is a provision in the settlement agreement which says something like this. It is understood and agreed by a releasor and releasees that this settlement is a compromise of a doubtful and disputed claims, and that the payment set forth herein is not to be construed as an admission of liability on the part of releasees by whom liability is expressly denied. I think the agreement is important for this reason. Excuse me.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm out of water. Sorry.
Can I grab a water?
We got water up here for you.
I apologize. It's all.
No problem.
Thank you.
It's Las Vegas, so we understand about the Vegas throat. Very famous in the showrooms
The reason I believe this is so important is that number one is our position that there's no such thing as a net recovery analysis under Nevada law. Nevada law is specifically a net judgment law, and it requires that in order to compare things, there has to be judgments entered in the particular proceeding. It is our position that the settlement which was entered into this case, cannot be used to offset the actual judgment which was obtained in this case because no judgment was entered. That's the rule that Nevada has right now, as set forth in what William Works versus the Coons. But even if this net recovery analysis did apply, I would submit that there is no basis upon which a court or Northern Nevada Homes could offset any amount of that settlement against this judgment for $7,800, which was obtained by GL Construction. And the reason for it is simply there was not a determination made as to liability, and in that agreement there was no apportionment of responsibility for that $362,500 between the two defendants. And so those are the two main ideas which I would like to convey to the court. There would be no basis upon which to offset the recovery made by Northern Nevada Homes against two defendants each of which had, were separate entities and which had different liabilities, if any. And for that reason, it's my contention that the appeal that was has been taken by Northern Nevada Homes should simply be rejected and dismissed.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
On the counterclaim, that really wasn't related to the other claim.
It wasn't related at all.
That was essentially a breach of an oral contract.
Correct.
And involving invoices that they really didn't dispute. That could have been brought easily as a separate standalone claim, correct, without being a counterclaim. You could have brought that as a...
It could have been done, that's correct.
Right.
It would not have been a compulsory counterclaim.
And I think Judge Stiglitz looked at it in that light, that they were unrelated. It could have been brought as a separate counterclaim, and the only judgment that was entered was in GL's favor, correct?
That's correct. And I think in Judge Stiglitz's opinion, I think it is evident, too, that she based her decision upon what I consider to be the net judgment rule, that there has to be judgments entered into the proceeding with which to offset.
Right.
Not just a settlement.
And there was an indication that, you know, the amount wasn't reasonable, although it's not an issue here. It wasn't contested. But you'd initially claimed $67,000+ for attorney's fees. She went through and determined what was reasonable in her mind. That was $10,000.
That's correct.
Correct? Okay.
And if you were to ask me, I think the attorney's fees were very, very reasonable because if I was going to be prepared to assert my counterclaim, okay, it was absolutely necessary, okay, that John Boyden, in his defense of the trespass claim, okay, would have to, okay, but minimize or defeat the claim of Northern Nevada Homes so that Northern Nevada Homes would not be able to assert that as an offset in my counterclaim. I had to follow along with the litigation that was going on, and I did so very sparingly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Beasley, I'm going to have you give the settlement agreement to the clerk to hold, and then you'll make a comment as to whether or not you want us to look at it. If you don't want us to look at it, tell us why. And then when we conference, we'll decide whether or not to look at it. So for now, it'll go to Ms. Brown over there and the settlement agreement. And then my colleagues will decide whether or not we're going to take a look at it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beasley.
Thank you for the water.
Mr. Rusby, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal. Before we start the clock on him, what's your feeling on the settlement agreement?
I have no problem with it. I don't see that the signatures of GL Construction or Gordon Lemich on here. I thought that that had occurred.
Do we have a signed copy?
No. What I did was yesterday or the day before, I contacted John Boyden and asked if he had a copy of the original settlement agreement. This is what he produced, which has the signature of Mr. Sherrill. I don't know whether he presented that to Gordy Lemich for signature or not. Probably because most likely he was an insurance defense counsel and he was just concerned about getting a signature for national indemnity.
You want to give us a signed copy? Have you got a signed copy?
This is the only copy that I have with me. It may be correct that it wasn't signed. The settlement was put on the record, and my point is that the settlement was on behalf of both GL Construction and Gordon Lemich, was paid by GL Construction's, essentially their agent, their indemnifying agent.
We'll have the clerk hold it, and we'll take a look at it then. Okay. We understand your position. Now we'll start the clock on your rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. To address the settlement agreement further, to say that this doesn't apportion between Gordon Lemich or GL Construction, I just don't think is accurate. The theories of liability were joint in several theories of liability. They signed a settlement agreement and paid money Had they not paid the money, we would have been able to sue for breach of contract against Gordon Lemich and GL Construction. In fact, all the money came from GL Construction. And so I don't think that argument that there is required to be some apportionment when a party has obligated themselves, GL Construction, to pay $362,000, that argument doesn't carry weight. And I would like to address Mr. Beasley's position, and I think this is really illustrative of the whole case, that their position has been that there's been minimal or no liability. And in fact, they forced us through 3 years of litigation. That issue was litigated in motion practice, summary judgment motions on both sides substantially. And then after hearing all the evidence, the court determined that there is no reasonable dispute as to fact on that issue. And that's why she entered judgment as a matter of law in our favor. And I think that that's illustrative of what we were dealing with in this entire case. There was no dispute that GL Construction and Mr. Lemich had dumped all their dirt, their trash on our property, and the whole case was about them not trying to take responsibility, not trying to move it, not trying to do anything. Their position was, it's your problem, too bad. And that is really illustrative of everything that has happened in this case. And I see that I'm out of time.
Well, thank you very much. The court thanks both Mr. Beasley and Mr. Rusby for your arguments, your briefs on this matter. Thank you. I know it was spirited, but that's okay. You did a good job, both of you. Congratulations. Your client should be very proud of you.